Good morning, and may it please the court.
Evgeny
Parkin from the Office of the Federal Public Defender for the appellant, Jose Granados. I will reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal, please.
All right, watch your clock.
Yes, Your Honor. The central issue in this case is whether police officers who stopped Mr. Granados because the light on his license plate was not working had reasonable suspicion that he was armed and presently dangerous and therefore could frisk him for a weapon. This court should hold they could not because there were no facts showing that he was armed and the facts showing dangerousness were not particularized to Mr. Granados at the time of the stop. In concluding otherwise, district court made 3 errors. First, its finding that Mr. Granados' movements and demeanor contributed to reasonable suspicion was wrong because it failed to account for facts that dispelled the officer's suspicions. Second, its reasoning that the marijuana and the time of the stop contribute to reasonable suspicion was contrary to this court's precedents. And third, the court's last factor, Mr. Granados' assault conviction, was not sufficient for reasonable suspicion because it did not indicate that he was armed and there were no particularized facts showing that he was dangerous because of that conviction during this traffic stop. I will elaborate on those errors as I discuss the government's 4 factors for reasonable suspicion. First is Mr. Granados' behavior during the stop. Here, the court should focus on the body cam videos. They show what happened, and because the district court found that the officers exaggerated when they testified about Mr. Granados' behavior. The videos show that Mr. Granados was calm, polite, and compliant during the stop. In assessing this factor, district court failed to account for facts that dispelled suspicion in 2 ways. First, it identified a movement that Mr. Granados made as furtive. But it was not a furtive movement. As the officer on the scene realized, Mr. Granados was reaching for his cell phone. The video shows that Mr. Granados leaned forward, got his cell phone, was starting to lean back when Officer Gomez, who was at his passenger side window, couldn't tell exactly what was going on, so he tapped on the window with his flashlight.
I looked at the video and I didn't see that he was reaching for a cell phone on the floor. That wasn't visible from the video.
I think the central question is whether it was a movement that could indicate to the officers that he was armed. And here the district court made 2 errors. It only considered the facts that happened until Officer Gomez tapped on the window. And after that happened, Officer Gomez testified that he realized that Mr. Granados was getting his cell phone. And he could see him afterwards being on his cell phone, using his cell phone, until Officer Glenn arrived. So Officer Gomez's behavior showed that he was not worried about that movement after Mr. Granados showed him that, hey, I was just getting my cell phone. And under Thomas versus Dillard, the district court had to consider all the facts, including facts that dispelled the officers' suspicions and were known to the officers at the time that the frisk occurred. And here the court's focus on only the facts up until the tap. The court was, that's what the court was concerned about, that there were some movements that led the officer to tap on the window. And that was the end of the deal for the district court. That's district court's discussion of that is at ER 99 to 104. And so the court failed to consider these facts that dispelled the officer's suspicion that Mr. Granados was not reaching for anything weird, doing anything furtive, but was doing a movement, but was just getting his cell phone. And the second way the court erred was in characterizing Mr. Granados as sweaty and therefore nervous during this traffic stop. The question for the court was whether anything about how Mr. Granados presented himself would leave the officer to conclude that he had a weapon. And here the video showed there was nothing like that. He was not evasive. He wasn't disobeying the officer's orders. And he was not unusually nervous when interacting with them. He was behaving normally.
So the police officer had a different impression and he testified it was based on his experience and training. And the Supreme Court has told us we can take that into account. Was it wrong to take that into account?
Well, I think First, the court found that the officers exaggerated, so it's not exactly clear what it was that is to be taken into account. But second of all, this court has also drawn a distinction between the kinds of behaviors that appearances that are normal in any kind of police interaction are to be expected, which is some level of nervousness, and the kinds of behaviors that indicate a weapon, which, for example, in Burkett and Brown were furtive movements that caused officers to actually react to those kinds of movements. And in United States versus IUV, this court explained that movement's not really furtive if an officer doesn't react to it in a way that's furtive.
I was just going to ask Mr. Pacman, I thought when the district court said that it concluded that some of the officer's testimony was exaggerated, the district court was specifically referring to furtive movements, not whether Mr. Granados was sweaty. As I recall in the body cam footage, the officer said, "You're really sweaty. Why are you so sweaty?" And he was clearly reacting to how sweaty he perceived Mr. Granados to be. And I don't recall the district court saying that that was in any way exaggerated.
I think that the exaggeration finding shows that the officers were misleading the court about Mr. Granados' behavior. So I think it can be read broader because the officers were trying to justify their actions in whatever way they could. But on the sweaty point, I think the court ignored Mr. Granada's corroborated explanation for why he was sweaty, and it was not because he was nervous. As he told the officers, he's a janitor. He had just finished a cleaning assignment. He was on his way to a different cleaning assignment, and corroborating that was he was in his work scrubs with his cleaning company's logo, Q, on his work shirt. And the court did not take into consideration that fact. But I think the other point that the court conflated was the difference between furtive and fidgety movements, and fidgety movements showing that a person is nervous, and furtive movements as movements showing that a person is actually might have a weapon on them. So in talking about that the officers exaggerated his movements, I think that goes to they exaggerated how fidgety he was in the car, which can also go to nervousness.
Yeah, so is this the case where, I'm just trying to, we've had so many cases this week. Did the officer admit that he was searched Granados pursuant to the San Francisco Police Department's unconstitutional policy of frisking all detained people?
That's exactly right. The officer.
How does that play into the analysis?
I think it shows that it undercuts the officer's testimony that he was doing anything in a way that caused them to actually search him, because it's a much harder case for us if there was none of this testimony, harder to convince the court that they were exaggerating. And it just confirms that there is nothing that he actually did that led to the search, but these are after the fact justifications for a search that actually happened under this policy where they believe that they're required to search anyone who's been lawfully stopped and is coming out of the car.
Would they have had probable cause to arrest Mr. Granados based on their observations of smoke coming out of the windows, the smell of marijuana, the burnt marijuana cigarette in the car? And if they did, wouldn't a pat down have been inevitable at that point?
No, Your Honor. So first, the government hasn't argued that they, in the district court, they haven't tried to justify this search as something.
But did they brief it, but just not argued at the hearing?
So the government opposition was focused on that the only relevant facts, the only grounds they try to justify the search on were that Mr. Granados was armed and dangerous, and therefore it could allow the frisk, and that they would have inevitably arrested him for this, pipe they found in his backpack. So those were the two grounds. They did not argue that they would have arrested him for any kind of marijuana offense. And so under the inevitable discovery, so first the argument is waived, but the important point on the inevitable discovery doctrine is that the burden was on the government to prove by a preponderance of evidence that the officers would have exercised their discretion to actually arrest someone. And here again, there's no evidence of that, even if we don't consider that waiver. At the suppression hearing, the officers did not testify that that would have happened. And the facts suggest that they wouldn't have. Also, we have not conceded that there's probable cause. And I think there's good arguments that there was not probable cause to arrest them. And further, it's not clear whether any of these marijuana offenses are something that a person would be arrested for rather than just issued a citation. For example, the having an open container of the marijuana, and as I argued, the federal offense, which again, the government has never argued and officers likely didn't have authority to do anything about that. But here there's no argument and there's no evidence they actually could have arrested Mr. Granados for those particular offenses. And that's important because it's the inevitable discovery context. So the government has to show that there actually is authority to arrest in that situation. If I may, Judge Wardlaw?
Yes, one other question. So I've looked at the video too, and I saw a cable car. That seems at odds with this notion that this could be this was a high crime area. Where exactly was it?
It's the top of Nob Hill, and the district court did not make a finding that this is a high crime area. I think both because the facts didn't support it, and also Officer Glenn, who's the only one that testified to this being a high crime area, was someone who the court found to exaggerate. I see that I'm actually past time, I believe.
Yes, you are, but I'll give you some time for rebuttal.
And
we'll hear from Ms. Parkman. No, I'm sorry. That's wrong. That's you. I'm sorry. Ms. James.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. I'm Assistant U.S. Attorney Alexis James, representing the government in this matter. The court should affirm the district court's finding that the officers had reasonable suspicion to frisk the defendant. The defendant's violent criminal history, the sweatiness during a cold nighttime, as well as the repeated furtive movements even after being warned to stop, including wiping of the palms, which to an officer's experience is something someone may do in order to better grip a weapon. All of this in the context of a nighttime stop gave officers more than a mere hunch that the defendant was armed and dangerous. I'm happy to answer any of the court's questions. Otherwise, I will turn to reasonable suspicion, the totality of the circumstances analysis, which this court, as well as the Supreme Court, has emphasized repeatedly is the starting point for that analysis.
Yeah, so let me ask you, the officers testified that the department had this unconstitutional policy of frisking all detained people exiting vehicles. How do we know that, given that policy, that these other reasons asserted by the officers weren't pretextual?
Well, first, Your Honor, and I want to refer to the record at ER 27 and 28. That's when there's this discussion about this policy versus procedure in the testimony. There is nothing in the record that says there is a written police policy that officers abide by in order to conduct these stops.
Counsel, they testified there was a policy. It's irrelevant whether it was written or spoken.
Well, Your Honor, they testified that it was procedure that they learned, but which the district court highlights in the record at ER 210, it's irrelevant that this policy does or doesn't exist, which is unclear if that is exactly the SFPD official policy, but it's irrelevant as long as reasonable suspicion is satisfied, which the district court found and the government contends it is. And so turning to a totality of the circumstances analysis, the context of this traffic stop occurred at night. This court has accepted that traffic stops are inherently dangerous. And as Officer Leach testified, they're even more dangerous in the context of nighttime. It's hard to see what's going on in the vehicle. But along with the nighttime traffic stop, there are these furtive movements. I would like to point out in the record that, yes, as counsel has pointed out, the court did indicate that there was some exaggerations about the motions. However, the court specifically stated in the record at 210 that, excuse me, ER 210, that there were exaggerations, but there were some furtive movements. The court specifically said that there were still some furtive movements. And looking at Officer Leach, sorry, I thought I heard a question. looking at Officer Leach and Officer Gomez's testimony, they talk about hands in the lap. They talk about the defendant having his hands by his thighs, reaching towards the floorboards. And then Officer Gomez taps the window, which is seen in body cam and is flagged by Judge Alsup in his opinion about reasonable suspicion that obviously something's going on here. Officer Gomez is tapping on the window. But even after Officer Gomez has tapped on the window to indicate to the defendant to stop doing whatever it is that he's doing, when Officer Glenn arrives on the scene, Officer Glenn observes that the defendant is looking around, and that's in the record at ER 133 and 134. The defendant is looking around. He's on his cell phone. He reaches towards the console and shakes a bottle. And Officer Glenn also notes that the defendant is profusely sweating. And this stood out in particular to Officer Glenn because it was a cold night. So he's sweating, it's a cold night, and then these fidgeting motions that aren't just one or two things. But then Officer Glenn observes that the defendant wipes his palms, which in Officer Glenn's experience, which is again in the record at ER 132, this was something that a suspect might do in order to get a better grip on a weapon. Further, in conjunction with all of those movements, the defendant also, once boarded out of the vehicle, walks in a way that gave officers suspicion that there may be a fight or flight moment. And that is in the record at ER 138, 139, as well as 111. But this, the court even interjects during the testimony at the record at 193, ER 193, the court even says, watching the body cam footage does give the court itself some idea that the defendant is thinking about doing something, whether it's flight or whatever the officers are testifying to, there is something there that the court felt the need to pull to talk about that. So in conjunction with the fact that this is a nighttime stop, there are several furtive movements and there's also drug involvement here. When Officer Leach approaches the defendant right at the beginning of the stop, Officer Leach observes smoke emanating from the vehicle. And when Officer Leach sees this, he also smells burnt marijuana. And this is in the record at ER 21. He then asks the defendant, what's going on? Are you smoking marijuana? Is that what's happening here? And according to Officer Leach's testimony, the defendant shows Officer Leach a marijuana cigarette and refers to it as a joint. And that's in the record at ER 29. But on this point about the marijuana, Officer Leach smells the marijuana. He smells the burnt marijuana. He sees the joint. But then Officer Gomez, who is on the passenger side of the vehicle where the window is rolled up, also smells the marijuana. And Officer Gomez even described it as a strong odor. And that's in his declaration at ER 219. But then after backup arrives, Officer Glenn arrives minutes later, and he still smells this odor of marijuana. So this is a pungent odor. So the court notes that the officer is investigating whether or not this is personal use, whether or not this is possession versus trafficking. The officer is in the midst of that investigation on scene, does indicate that there could be drugs as well as gun possession, as those two things go together. And that's in the court's opinion at ER 210, but courts have found that drugs and guns do often go together. And so on top of having all of the factors that I just mentioned, the furtive movements, it's a nighttime stop, officers are unable to see what the defendant is grabbing when he's reaching towards the floorboards and things of that nature, officers also observe that the defendant has a criminal history, a violent criminal history and a recent criminal history. Officer Leach testifies in the record at ER 23 and 26 that this was a 2016 conviction. This stop occurred at 2018. So it's a recent conviction. And also the defendant received an 8-year sentence for an assault with likely to occur great bodily injury. So this is a violent criminal history and it's a recent one. And in fact, the court stated in its a ruling in the record at ER 210 to 211 that this was a significant factor. Because the fact that this defendant was recently convicted and for a violent crime means that he in particular is more dangerous than just someone, any old person driving on the street. Your Honor, I see that there are no questions. But reiterating my point, with all of these together, the court has ruled that the court below ruled that that was more than a mere hunch and was less than a fair probability, which is all that is required for reasonable suspicion. And so if there are no further questions, I respectfully ask this court to affirm.
I have a question. Is a finding that this area was a high crime area critical to your argument?
No, Your Honor. In fact, the court below didn't even reach the high crime area finding because Judge Alsup found that there was enough with just the factors that the government has listed to the court today, that there was no need to reach it. While the government still contends that it was a high crime area, there was enough reasonable suspicion without it, Your Honor.
Ms. James, did the government waive its argument of inevitable discovery and the suppression balancing argument before the district court?
No, Your Honor. If you look in the record at FER 30, the government specifically talks about inevitable discovery in its briefing. Now, it did not reach that argument during oral argument, which is not required for waiver, but also it didn't reach it because the court found reasonable suspicion. So the inevitable discovery argument is briefed in FER 30. But to go further into that point, I would like to highlight that officers had probable cause to search the vehicle. And in the record at ER 125, the parties do not dispute that. And the court indicates that it agrees that that probable cause existed to search the vehicle. Inside the vehicle, once officers searched it, there are three unsealed bags of marijuana, a jar of marijuana, as well as a pipe with suspected methamphetamine residue on the pipe. So those three factors show that not only could officers have arrested the defendant, but a reasonable officer would have, considering that this is not just marijuana possession at this point. We now have this pipe with suspected methamphetamine residue on it. And so because they could have and likely would have, they then would have searched the defendant, and incident to that a search because of the arrest would have also discovered the loaded firearm. Your Honor.
Right. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Mr. Parkman, I'll give you a couple minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. I will touch on 3 points. One, the inevitable discovery doctrine. Government counsel argued that they likely would have searched Mr. Granados. That's not enough for the standard. The inevitable discovery doctrine specifically says there must be no speculative elements. So that's speculation that forecloses it. Also, Mr. Granados argued below in the district court that the search of the vehicle was not legal. And because the government in its answering brief only did not go that route, we just did not challenge it because the gun was not the fruit of the search of the vehicle. Next, I'd like to address the marijuana and the assault. Now there's a stub of a marijuana cigarette in the ashtray of Mr. Ganaza's car, and he admitted that he had recently smoked it. And what the officers offered was this faulty syllogism that a little bit of drugs means more drugs means a gun. And that's contrary to this court's decisions in Ramirez versus City of Buena Park and Thomas versus Dillard, where this court held that drug use is not indicative of a weapon, and United States versus IV, which said that while drug dealing is, there has to be some evidence of a drug transaction. And especially egregious here, where the substance is legal in San Francisco, a person could buy it at a store. So whatever inference might be available, if it was an illegal substance that a person had to buy from a drug dealer, is completely absent when it's marijuana in San Francisco. So the court's reasoning was wrong there, and this court should step in.
I just feel it's necessary to clarify that marijuana remains illegal under federal law.
Well, I think the reasonable analysis looks at what's the situation on the ground. And in San Francisco, it's no longer this shadowy activity. It's something that's out in the open to be purchased at a store. So there's no inference that marijuana in San Francisco under the Fourth Amendment's reasonable analysis leads to an inference of a gun. And the last piece is the self-conviction. I'll just quickly mention that it was not for a crime that involved, the self-conviction did not indicate that Mr. Granados had a weapon, because it's not a crime that needed to involve a weapon. And there's no particularized analysis like in United States versus Torres, which both parties discussed the 10th Circuit case. And with that, I'll just finish by saying that the frisk was illegal, the exclusionary rule applies, and this court should reverse the judgment of the district court.
All right, thank you very much, counsel. United States versus Granados will be submitted.